Good evening, and I'd like to welcome you this evening to a discussion on the recent announcement for evidence of life on Mars. You, of course, have all heard about this. It's had tremendous coverage in the media. This discussion is hosted by the School of Physics at the University of Melbourne, and my name's Keith Nugent. I'm the current head of the School of Physics. In this talk, we've assembled some experts on the evidence for life on Mars. And the aim of this talk is, I think, to allow you to make your own judgment on whether life really has been found on Mars. So what we've done is assemble a group of experts to discuss each of the specific aspects of this discovery. And we should perhaps put discovery in inverted commas, because we cannot yet say for certain whether life has indeed been discovered. First up, after me, I will invite Dr. Rachel Webster, an astrophysicist with the School of Physics, and Rachel will introduce Mars to you as a planet and its history. Following Rachel, I'll invite Dr. Michael Hicks from the University of Arizona, who's currently visiting the School of Physics. Michael's an expert on meteorites and will discuss the meteorite itself. He'll explore the evidence that the meteorite did indeed come from Mars, because, of course, that's one of the key questions. Following Michael, I'll invite Professor David Jamieson, also from the School of Physics, and an expert on the analysis techniques used. He will explore the measurements that were made and discuss their reliability. Following that, Steve McLaughlin is a paleobotanist from the School of Botany. Steve's an expert at looking for the signs of life in rocks, and will discuss the meaning of the evidence that has been uncovered. Finally, Rachel will return to explore the consequences of this discovery for the prospects of finding intelligent life in the universe somewhere, or the prospects of there being intelligent life in the universe. So, there's a summary of the talk. There's the introduction, which I'm just giving you now. The history of the Earth, the history of Mars. How do we find Mars rocks on Earth? What was found? How do we find ancient life, and where now for alien life in the universe? A guide for what I think perhaps you might like to think about as we go through this evidence are four questions, which are briefly outlined there. The researchers use tests based on what we know about life on Earth. Now, of course, there's very little reason to expect that life on Mars will be all that similar to life on Earth. And is it just possible that what the researchers found was evidence that they were looking for rather than genuine evidence of life on Mars? So I'd invite you to think about whether, in fact, this is just a sign, whether this is a true finding of life, or perhaps just some fragmented pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that many suggest life but are far from conclusive. If the conclusions are correct, does that therefore mean that life on Mars has developed in a very similar way to life on the Earth? And if that's true, that's a very interesting point, interesting insight into the development of the evolution of life. How is it that life could be so similar on two totally different planets? Another question, which perhaps you can think about, whether the life in fact originated on Earth. This is something which perhaps we can explore in question time later on. Did the life originally come from Earth, get blasted into space, arrive on Mars, and then get blasted back again? The probability of this is very low, I think, and so that means that if we do take this as life on Earth, as evidence for life, then it really is life on Mars. And finally, if indeed there is life on Mars, then life has evolved on the only two planets where we've looked in detail for life. This would seem to imply that perhaps life could evolve everywhere where it's conceivable that it could do so. That's a very important insight. I propose that we don't take questions during this talk between speakers. I would invite you to think of questions and we'll throw the meeting open for discussion at the end of the talk when all the speakers have said their piece. Finally, I'd just like to put up this timeline for this meteorite where this evidence for life will stand. You can see there that if we follow it through, that the planet Earth formed 4.6 GY stands for giga years, that's 10 to the 9 years or 1 billion years or a billion years, that's 4.6 billion years. The Mars meteorite crystallized approximately 4.5 billion years ago. The oldest rocks of which we have evidence on Earth are something like 3.9 billion years ago, as indeed are the oldest fossils that we found on Earth. The meteorite that we're talking about tonight was blasted into space, we believe, from Mars 15 million years ago. It landed in Antarctica only 13,000 years ago, relatively small time frame at this point, and so spent many millions of years floating through space before arriving on Earth. And then, of course, in 1984, the meteorite was found, and just a couple of weeks ago, the announcement of the possible life on Earth was announced. So that's the timeline for this meteorite, and it might be useful, again, for you to hold that in mind as we go through this discussion tonight. So I'll leave that on the overhead projector for speakers to refer to through the talks. So, to open the technical discussion of the evidence for life, I'd now like to invite Dr. Rachel Webster to discuss the development of and history of the planet Mars.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Keith. And we thought we would start this evening by introducing the planet Mars and placing it in its context in the solar system so that you have some idea of why scientists have been so receptive to the idea that indeed life might have formed on Mars, if not, or if it isn't there now, at least it might once have been there. Mars is often referred to as the red planet, and in the video that I'm going to show you in a few minutes, you'll certainly see why that is. It's most of its surface is in fact quite red in colour, except around the poles where we have the equivalents of polar ice caps. Mars we can certainly regard as the planet that is most like the Earth. It's not our nearest neighbour, but it's in fact our second nearest neighbour, and it definitely has a mass about 10% of the mass of Earth. So what we have is a planet that is somewhat similar in size to the Earth, and in fact we think probably evolved in a very similar way. If we look at the geology of Mars, at the present time we would say that Mars is geologically probably dead. What that means is that there's probably no volcanoes, no plate movements, no earthquakes, the sort of thing that we would normally associate with a lively geological planet. Now, the sort of geological features, though, that we see on Mars indicate that Mars probably once did have the sort of geology that we're familiar with on Earth. So, for example, we certainly see volcanoes on the surface of Mars. We see impact craters, which would have resulted from lumps of rock from space hitting the surface, and we see evidence for flowing water on the surface as well. There's also one very large feature, sort of canyon-like feature on the surface of Mars, which again we're going to see in the video. Now, Mars, I've said already that it has polar ice caps. It actually has seasons as well. The axis, the rotation axis, that Mars revolves around is at pretty much the same sort of angle as the Earth's axis, and so basically as it travels around the Sun, one or other of the polar ice caps will melt, and you can see the actual movement of those polar ice caps as the seasons change. Now the surface at the present time though is really quite desert-like and dusty. So what we have is really a rocky desert with a couple of polar ice caps and the residual features of things like volcanoes. So what we're going to do now is actually have a look at a video which is put together from the Viking mission trials. And what's happened here is we'll just watch the video first and then I'll explain. We've got a flyover motion over the surface of Mars that's been created by a flight simulator. The actual photographs, though, actually, what we're going to do, I'm afraid the video has run. Yeah. Okay. You can never win on these things. Michael, you might like... We'll see if we can get Michael to wind the video back. For some reason or other, the video has run forward from where I set it. So we're going to have to look at the video in a few minutes. Okay. What I plan to do now is to actually take you through a rough evolution of the Earth while Michael gets that video organised. And... and show you the main stages of the evolution of the Earth and why each of these stages, or how each of these stages is actually reflected in the evolution of Mars. Now, the first main stage in the evolution of the Earth was the actual aggregation of the rocks that went to form the Earth. And you can see a rough little diagram here. And the basic idea is that we have a lot of rocks floating around in the solar system. These rocks came together just by the natural collisions that you would expect in a group of rocks, and eventually formed something that was about the size of the Earth. Now, all of the impacting of these rocks, one on each other, actually caused the body to become quite warm. And when it's warm, a process called differentiation occurs. Basically, what that means is that the heavy rocks sink towards the center of the body. In this case, we're talking about the Earth, and the lighter rocks remain at the surface. Because the rocks are quite warm, we have a molten core here, and if there are fractures in the rocks, then this gives the possibility that you can have things like volcanoes occurring. So basically, in the early stages of the Earth, we expect that there was quite a lot of molten lava and volcanic action occurring. Also, in these processes, we get something called outgassing happening. That simply means that as the volcanoes go off, there's a lot of gas coming out, and that will actually form an atmosphere around the planet. Okay, so the aggregation started about 4.6 billion years ago, and the differentiation and outgassing about 3.9 billion years ago. And what we then are left with is a small Earth, or at least an Earth more or less the size it is, with quite a heavy atmosphere. Certainly no life at this stage. However, we know that the Earth was, or the temperature of the surface of the Earth was such that we could have liquid water. And basically, we believe that that liquid water was a crucial element in the formation of life on Earth. The liquid water principally provided a shield from the ultraviolet radiation from the sun, and that enabled any life forms which formed to in fact evolve quite happily in the oceans, shielded from from the sun's UV radiation. All of this was going on probably around about 3.5 billion years ago. We don't have exact datings on that, but that's the approximate time. Okay, so the question then is, if that's how Earth evolved, what do we think happened on Mars? Well, the crucial thing here is that we think that the basic evolution on Mars was very, very similar to the processes that I've outlined here on Earth. So let's just go down the list and have a look and see what we think happened on Mars. We certainly think that Mars formed, the planet actually got together by a process of aggregation. So there were lots of lumps of rock that slowly stuck together and eventually formed the planet. And the timescale would have been about the same as the Earth. This process again would have heated the planet up, and we would have had differentiation occurring and outgassing. So what we've got at this stage is a smaller planet, but a planet that is still formed in exactly the same way as the Earth and has these surface features that hopefully we will see on the video if we can ever get it sorted out. Okay, and then finally, of course, the last question, the last point that we're not too sure about is, did life actually evolve on Mars? Well, we have evidence for liquid water on the surface, and I'm just going to summarise that in a moment. And so we actually have the first precondition on Mars that we thought was in fact necessary for life to form on Earth. So it's kind of looking like, certainly from the astronomer's point of view, that Mars is a good place to go and look for the possible existence, at least in the past, of life. Now before I just finish up on this, I just want to briefly show you why we're so convinced about water on Mars. The primary evidence, there are really two pieces of evidence for water on Mars. The first is that if we look at the surface of Mars, then we see very, very clear evidence for features in the surface that look like they were created by flowing water. So I've got an overhead transparency here, which I think shows it reasonably well. And you can see, indeed, that there are channels here. Basically, it looks like creek beds, as you would see, or river beds, that you would see if you looked at Earth from outer space. And you can see there's a channel along here as well. We think these features were, in fact, formed by moving water. And there really are, there are lots of features like this on the surface of Mars. We can also have a look at another one here. And here, you can see these sort of droplets. There's an impact crater being formed here, and it looks like water was flowing past the impact crater. I'll see if I can get my hand moving in the right direction here. Actually forming, going past the impact crater, and in fact forming that strange shape that we see there. So it definitely seems like there was water on Mars at one stage. Is there still water there? Well, yes, indeed, we think there's still water there. Those polar ice caps that I was talking about, some of the polar ice caps is definitely frozen carbon dioxide, but some of it must be water. We know the temperatures of those regions, and the carbon dioxide would certainly evaporate at the surface temperatures that we see those polar ice caps at. In addition to that, a somewhat more technical observation, we can actually see hydrogen gas escaping from the surface of Mars, and basically that comes about because the water molecules have been zapped again by these ultraviolet photons from the sun. They've been broken up into hydrogen and oxygen, and we can actually see the hydrogen escaping from the gravitational field on the planet Mars. Okay, so we've got a planet here that to all intents and purposes looks like early Earth. Did we get the video? Okay, let's see if we can actually run through this video. While Michael's getting that running, as I said, the actual pictures that were taken by the Viking lander, and basically what they've done,
Mars,
is to set up
the fourth planet
flight
from the sun,
simulator,
is visible to the naked
those
eye as a bright
and
star
puts them
in the night
all together
sky.
In a video, and so you,
through
you
a telescope
that
appears as a yellowish brown disk of indications of complex features. However,
now, we start
using
here,
images taken by cameras on the Viking orbiter spacecraft, a simulated flight
Mars,
over Mars reveals much more
the
detail.
Great gash down the side, which we're going to fly over.
These are shaded relief maps
the,
of the topography
the,
of the Earth and Mars,
Earth,
rendered on a sphere.
The
diameter of Mars is 4,202 miles, or about 53% of Earth's. The planet's volume is about 15% of Earth's. A comparison of the relative size of each planet to the size
of
its surface features
demonstrates
the enormity of the Martian terrain. The Mars elevations were derived from stereographic analysis of
the
Viking orbiter imagery. For scaling, the outline of the
continent
is
I suppose if we've been making a video, video, we would have done something similar. Anyway, it's just to give you an idea of the sort of scale of the region that the flight simulator is going to fly over.
Two times the height of Mount Everest.
Those are the volcanoes.
And the Valles Marineris.
This region
a system
here,
of enormous canyons over 3,000 miles long.
About 3,000.
This Viking orbiter image mosaic was used for
video,
the flight simulation.
The
line being drawn follows the
this
flight
is the
path.
Flight
elevations vary from 500 miles to 3 miles above the surface.
The relief
is exaggerated 5 times when the natural color enhances
but
the visual interpretation of small surface features. For centuries, Mars has captivated observers on Earth. Unmanned spacecraft and scientific data visualization have increased our interest in and knowledge of the Red Planet.
How can one get a meteorite from Mars, and then once you find one, how do you know that it actually did come from Mars? And to start with that, we'll start with an artist's representation of the process. Basically, in this painting, we see the effects of a giant impact on Mars. This impact would be a body of about, let's say, 10 kilometers or 20 or 30 kilometers in diameter, a moderate-sized asteroid, plunging, wailing into Mars. Now, this sort of impact happens frequently. You can just look at the cratering record on the surface, and you see that it's happened, you know, many, many dozens of times. Basically, we only in the last 20 years we've kind of recognized the fact that these sort of impacts are like basically nuclear explosions. It's a lot of energy being dumped in a very small area. And what happens is that the seismic wave, the primary compressive pulse expanding from the impact site, when it comes to the surface, can eject small fragments at very, very high velocities into space. This process is called spallation. And we see these various chunks of debris. They float around in interplanetary space for millions of years until either they collide with the sun, or hit a planet, are ejected or are ejected from the solar system, only about 7% of debris that you would launch from Mars would actually hit the Earth. Most of it actually falls into the Sun. And here we have that little piece now plunging into a planet. Well, what planet it is? Well, it's our planet, and it's now entering our atmosphere, as you see here. So now this process also works for the Moon. In fact, there's about 10 meteorites recovered that have been identified as lunar material. But the time scale is a little bit different. When something is ejected from Mars, it tends to hang out in outer space on the order of like 100, 200 million years. The Moon, being much closer to us, it's more or less swept up by the Earth on timescales of 1 million years. Ejecta from the Earth, in fact, seeding other planets, and from Venus, well, while it's conceivable, it's much less likely, and that is, if you think about it, the Earth is much more massive, and it has a much stronger gravity. It would take ejecta being, you would need to, you know, drop kick the rock, you know, in fact, on the order of like 8 times the energy to actually make it escape from the Earth-Moon system. Also, when you think about Venus, it's also cloaked by a very thick atmosphere, and any pieces trying to punch their way back through would also be slowed down. Now let's look at a picture of a Martian meteorite. This one is called EETA. Well, let's just call it Rock 1. This one, in fact, when you see a little designation with lots of numbers and letters, you pretty much know that it was a meteorite recovered from Antarctica. In fact, Antarctica is a very, very profitable place to go meteorite hunting, because basically the Earth is being pelted more or less uniformly from every direction. Some of those meteorites actually hit the Antarctic ice sheet and become entrenched in the ice. And this ice is flowing, and it takes the meteorites with it. Now, most of the meteorites are lost, of course, when the ice calves into the ocean. But there are a few places where mountain ranges pop up and block the ice flow, and the meteorites are brought back to the surface where you can see them just on the ground, just right at their feet. Basically, every summer, there's expeditions to the Antarctic ice fields where they pick up meteorites by the hundreds, in fact. Now, this meteorite right here, Rock 1, is 8 kilograms, and you can see it's light pinkish color. That's a big clue. It's a basalt, just like granite is a kind of basalt. Basalts are igneous rocks, which mean that they crystallize from a melt. And that's the first clue that you know that this meteorite is actually from another planet, because only the larger only large terrestrial planets and the larger asteroids have enough heat during their formation to actually have some sort of melting and have rocks like this form. You also can see on this rock some remnants of something called the fusion crust. This is caused by the intense heat of plowing through our atmosphere when it lands. You can also the same sort of heat often kind of ablates grooves and channels into the rock. This particular meteorite must have been laying on the Antarctic ice shield for quite some time, because you can see that a lot of its fusion crust has been weathered away. This was a very important meteorite, because inside, if we would cut this particular meteorite apart and look at it, we'd see that it's filled with all these dark blotches. And these blotches are glass, which was created by the shock of being launched into space. These glasses, because they cool, glass is a mineral which we quench it very rapidly. Well, it cooled rapidly enough to trap in a little bit of gas that was around when it was formed. Well, this gas, we can extract this gas and analyze it and try to ask where can it have come from. This was done, in fact, not by me, but by other people. And here's the main results. This plot talks about the concentration of various gases in certain gases in the gas in general collected from the circuit, this one meteorite, versus Mars' atmosphere over here. That's a log scale, So this is particles per cubic centimeter, a billion particles, 100 billion, 10,000 billion, a million billion particles. It's a lot of particles, but we see that when we compare the two, CO2 carbon dioxide, the most abundant constituent in the atmosphere of Mars, plots right here. Well, where does it plot for Mars? Well, more or less in the exact same spot. Well, then you were lucky once. What about nitrogen? Yes, and argon and neon. They all match. This is very, very strong evidence for this meteorite to come from Mars. Basically, because Mars has a very unique atmosphere. Rachel was talking about the outgassing and the fact that the Mars is less massive. The fact that it's less massive means that the lighter constituents in the atmosphere can escape much faster, leaving behind a. That's why Mars atmosphere is very thin and dominated by CO2. There's no other place in the solar system which can match this signature at all. Now this sort of test was not done for the meteorite we're going to talk about later, the one where the evidence of life was found, well, because it doesn't have the same sort of glasses in it, but it does have other sort of traces that you can use. In fact, in the life meteorite, there was oxygen isotopes and the mineralogy, which more or less cement the fact that, yes, it was from Mars. So now, if there's anything I'd like you guys to take away from my little section of the talk, is these three points. The first one is that large impacts knock debris into space. This was not recognized until just recently. And you should also keep in mind that Mars is a much smaller planet. It's much easier to knock debris from Mars into the Earth than Earth to Mars. The second thing you should know now is that we have Martian meteorites. Meteorites we know are from Mars, and there's now about 12 of them. And they range from a little tiny 10-gram recent Antarctic find, to one of the very first ones we found, which was a 40-kilogram Nakhla meteorite. This meteorite landed near a small town in Egypt in 1911, and supposedly killed a small dog. Now, it's kind of ironic, in fact, that the first known meteoric fatality, well, except for the dinosaurs, was in fact from a visitor from another planet. Oh my goodness. You should also know, though I haven't really discussed it much, is that within these Martian meteorites, they have a very wide range of ages. When a rock crystallizes, a clock is set, a kind of radioactive clock is set. You can tell how old a rock is. And in fact, the life rock that we'll be discussing was crystallized 4.5 billion years ago. It's one of the earliest known rocks anywhere. Now, most of the other Martian meteorites are much younger, though. The Nakhla is, in fact, like that big, the big one that hit the dog, is 1.3 billion years ago. And in fact, the most recent ones are only 170 million years ago. Now that is a very interesting observation, because Michael was discussing how Mars is a geologically dead planet. It was formed about 5 billion years ago, but now it seems to be dead. Well, this is showing you that there was actually, if this igneous rock crystallized only 170 million years ago, there was near-surface volcanism as early as 170 million years ago. That's practically yesterday in geologic times. That makes all the talk of hydrothermal vents still at work on Mars much more credible, because we know, at least on the timescale of a few hundred million years, there still was active volcanism. Now that we've discussed, another thing I should point out is, though this Mars rock is 4.5 billion years old, it's kind of a fractured rock. And inside these little fractures are much younger carbonates. These carbonates were deposited by flowing water. Let's maybe put it up the time limit again. So the planets formed, including Mars, 4.5 billion years ago. As soon as it became solid crust, this particular meteorite formed. The oldest rocks are from are 3.9 billion years. 3.8 billion years ago, the carbonates formed water. Whereas on the Earth, the oldest fossils, this is a typo, the oldest fossils are around 3.5 billion years old. This would mean that the carbonates in this meteorite predate terrestrial life, evidence for life, which is, so did life evolve on Mars first? So it may seem. The meteorites blasted into space about 15 billion years ago. How do we know that? Well, we know this because when you once you blast something into space, it gets bombarded by cosmic rays, which leave a little signature in the crystal structure. And you just count up the cosmic rays, you can tell how old it is. This particular meteorite spent about 15 million years in space. Then it landed in Antarctica, as we said, was found, and now we analyze it. So now we have the meteorite. And David Jamieson is now going to talk about, well, what was inside this meteorite.
Okay, thanks, Michael. Basically want to just go through very quickly what was actually found inside the meteorite, and I'm very fortunate in this because all the information was put on the World Wide Web straight away, well before the results were published in the journal Science. So this is fantastic now that even in this remote corner of the planet, we can still keep up to date with what's going on in the other remote corners of the planet. Okay, so basically what I want to do is talk to you about how to search for evidence for life in this particular meteorite. And we've just seen from Michael how it's possible to find Mars rocks on Earth. Well, that's very nice. Saves us having to go to Mars to get them. Now, we're going to search for life. What are we going to look for? The scientists who have studied this rock have decided what we're going to look for is essentially the same sort of stuff as you find in Earth life, because you've got to start somewhere. And so it makes sense, therefore, to look for traces of life in the Mars life in the Mars rocks. And the traces that they've found, or they claim to have found, basically fall into two categories. We've got the chemical traces, and we've also got microscopic traces, which are sometimes called fossils. Now, let me just quickly give you a quick rundown on the history of the search for life on Mars, because this topic has a very rich and fantastic history, it has to be said. In the beginning, the early astronomers looking through telescopes at Mars, a somewhat difficult telescopic object, it's always rather small. In times of good seeing, they thought they saw features on the surface of the planet that could have been channels, the Italian word canali, and this was translated, of course, into canals, and Percival Lowell believed that he was seeing the remains of an artificial irrigation system as a dying Martian civilization attempting to pipe water from the canals down to their cities, but of course we now know this is completely wrong, and in fact, when I was a young lad, the very first close-up photos of Mars started coming in from the Mariner probe, and no canals whatsoever were visible, and I was extremely upset at this. All you could see were a whole lot of craters and stuff that looked like the surface of the moon, and I knew the ancient Martian civilizations were doomed. But anyway, later on in the mid-70s, the two Viking landers went to Mars, equipped with automatic laboratories, specifically designed to look for living organisms in the soil of Mars. And as the data came filtering down over the radio downlink, the initial data looked very promising, and everybody got tremendously excited. It was a miracle you could do this. The little automated laboratory was only about this big. You know, you could tuck it under your arm and carry it around. This thing was designed to take dirt in one end and send yes or no out the other end. And as more and more data came out of this thing, the initial promising results that were very highly suggestive of organism biological activities in the dirt turned out that probably were not true, and that Nevertheless, it was necessary to propose some kind of unusual chemistry in the Martian soil to account for the data, but it wasn't thought to be due to life processes. So the general conclusion after Viking sitting on the surface of Mars was that Mars did not have life as we know it. So what's new now? Okay, well, we have to look at what was in this meteorite. And the there were these basic categories of things that were found in the meteorite. First of all, complicated chemicals were found. Then a lot of carbonates were found associated with those complicated chemicals. And then some unusual distributions of two different iron compounds, magnetite and pyrites or iron sulfides, were found associated with those carbonates. They also saw these tiny shapes, which could well be fossils or maybe not. And furthermore, there were some subtle details associated with the distribution of carbon isotopes. The two main isotopes of carbon are treated slightly differently by life processes, and those ratios were also suggestive of life processes. The key finding is that all of these things, this quite long list of things, any one of which taken by itself could have an alternative explanation that didn't involve life, but the key thing is they're all found together in the one place, and that is the most surprising fact about the discovery. So before I talk about each of the individual discoveries, I've just brought along my model of the meteorite here for you to look at. This is almost exactly the right size, the right shape, and the right colour of the meteorite that was found, except this actually is a potato instead of a meteorite. Nevertheless, I think you can imagine slicing this up and looking inside it and searching for the presence or the residue, the traces of living organisms. So PAH is a polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon. This is a molecule that can easily be produced by non-life processes, but is also typically associated with fossils of earth organisms. And these molecules are extremely stable. I've just got a picture of one here for you to help you visualise the shape a little better. I can make it spin around for you. It's a nice flat molecule, and while I'm making the molecule spin, I can I'll spin the planet as well for you. This is these are some Hubble pictures all pasted together, and so the data for the molecule is very solid. It's easy to detect these traces in the Mars rocks, and the way this was done was simply by cutting up the rock and feeding it into this laser mass spectrometer, which boiled off some of the molecules that were left there, fed them into a mass spectrometer, and we see these signals characteristic of varying amounts of increasing amounts of complexity in these molecules. The simple ones are easy to understand, and as you get up higher and higher in the distribution, there may be evidence for even more complicated ones. And again, in Earth fossils, we always see large amounts of very complicated assemblages of these molecules as a result of the fossils, the ancient life. So that's a good sign. The next step then, having looked at the molecular evidence, was to zoom in and look at the structural evidence. Could you turn that back on, thanks? Of course, most of the things here are too small to look at with the naked eye. Once you start looking for things that are smaller than a millionth of a metre, such as characteristic of very primitive cells, you can't use, first of all, you obviously can't use the naked eye. You can't use an optical microscope because light can't see things that small. You have to use the electron microscope. And the electron microscope is just like a light microscope, except the electrons can see things that are much smaller than you can with light. So here's some data from the meteorite. Showing blobs of carbonates inside the meteorite from slices, and these could well be residues of ancient biological activity. The key thing here is that we have the carbonate and it's surrounded by these black rims in the greenish rock matrix. These are very small, between 1 and 250 millionths of a metre in size. The electron microscope not only shows you what things look like, it also tells you what elements are present there. And that's how we know those black rims are made of iron and whatnot, because we can actually make images on the basis of the elemental distributions there, and these are also highly suggestive of having been put there by life processes. So we have the elements, we have the molecules, we zoom in now and look at the shapes. This is the famous photo that's appeared in a lot of newspapers showing what has been interpreted by some people as tiny, tiny fossils, actually much smaller than you'd probably expect for there to be direct fossils. And in the actual paper itself, they say these are just residues of life processes. They're not necessarily fossils. They're only about a tenth of a millionth of a metre in size. Here are some others. Again, you're seeing little blobs, elongated things, all very, very tiny, but nevertheless remarkably shaped, because natural processes tend to produce symmetrical shapes, not these elongated ones. And furthermore, if you look at the chemical mixture involved in some of these shapes, you see mixtures of oxidized iron and reduced iron all interlocked. And that's kind of unusual, because most natural processes either oxidize the stuff or they reduce the stuff. You don't have these two opposing types of reactions occurring right next to each other in a natural process. But in life, unnatural things happen all the time. Furthermore, some of the shapes of these tiny things are very suggestive of things that you see also in earth dirt. So on the right, on the end here, we see an iron sulfide particle from the a root bounding a lump of dirt. And in the middle picture there, B, we see a similar particle seen in the meteorite, possibly from a Martian organism. So having taken all those things together, it's extremely suggestive that there was, in fact, it could well have been all put there because of the activity of ancient organisms. So what is to be done now? Well, the World Wide Web is already alive with critics and skeptics who are proposing alternative explanations for everything I've just explained there. And so it's necessary to take some more slices off the potato, off the meteorite, and send it to other laboratories, double-check the results. We should look at some of the other Mars meteorites and see if we see the same things. And it's also been proposed actually to send a robot space probe to Mars to return a sample. But in my view, if you're going to look for something as complicated as fossils left by unknown organisms who had unknown habitats, it's too complicated for robots. You've got to send physicists, preferably the dudes, as you'll see this guy in the corner here, to take a close-up look in person. You really should go to Mars. So with that in mind, I shall now ask Stephen to come and tell us what sort of things these guys should be looking for.
Okay.
Yeah, switch to that.
All right. First of all, we should ask ourselves what we mean when we talk about fossil evidence. And the term fossil refers to any sign or any evidence of past life. And now there are two principal categories of fossils. There are body fossils and there are trace fossils. Now, body fossils are simply any preserved parts or holes of dead organisms, plants, animals, fungi, bacteria. And there are about five principal ways that bodies are fossilized. We have preservation of hard parts, like mineralized parts of an animal, skeletal parts, teeth, those sort of things. Now, no one's suggesting these sort of fossils on Mars. Another category are coalified remains. It's usually when we're talking about plant fossils. Coal seams are simply compressed, tumefied, and coalified plant matter, but it essentially retains the same organic constituents of the original plant. Third type are impression fossils. These are simply imprints or negative images of ancient life. So in this case, a twig of a conifer and fourth type is cast fossils. And this is where an organism might be buried in the sediment, decays away, leaves a cavity in the rock. That cavity is later filled in with other sedimentary matter or mineral particles, and so we get a three-dimensional cast, in this case a tree stump, but we have no internal anatomical details. It's just a simple cast. The fifth category is petrifaction or demineralization. This is where minerals impregnate or infiltrate buried organic tissues and precipitate in the cellular cavities. So we get, in some cases, quite exquisite three-dimensional preservation of cellular structures. Of course, the other major class of fossils are trace fossils. Now, these are simply any indirect evidence of past life, and that can include trackways and trails and burrows, feeding traces, and even more indirect evidence like biomineralization deposits and geochemical signatures which are indicative of past organic activities like photosynthesis or respiration. Now, it's this latter category that we're talking about when we're looking at the evidence for mesantarctic meteorites. We're looking at things like carbon isotope signatures, chemical hydrocarbon concentrations, and structural features of the surfaces of some of these carbonate blocks that look like biomineralization deposits. And also associations of minerals that don't usually occur together outside of biological activity. And this is that sort of indirect evidence is something is also what we use to interpret some of the earliest signs for life on Earth. So the oldest rocks that we've seen on Earth are around 3.9 billion years old. The planet itself probably accreted around 4.5 billion years old. Well, why don't we get any rocks older than 3.9 billion? It's because Earth is a very geologically active place, so the surface rocks are constantly being eroded, reworked, resedimented, subducted, volcanic activity, metamorphism, all these things tend to rework the surface of the Earth, so we don't get any really old rocks. The oldest evidence for actual body fossils on Earth is around 3.5 billion years old. And this evidence comes from the Pilbara district in Western Australia. And it's in the form of simple, vague filamentous structures with a carbonaceous rim. They're preserved in siliceous deposits. These simple filaments, some of them have septa, divided up into individual cells. But they're also associated with stromatolites, these laminated dome-shaped structures, which are sedimentary structures built up by the sediment accumulating activity of phototrophic organisms like blue-green algae, cyanobacteria. And we see almost identical structures today forming in places like Shark Bay, again in Western Australia. And so by analogy, we can assume that there was the same sort of process that we were going on back then. These very old signs of life are also associated with sulfate deposits, sedimentary sulfate, which is an oxygen-rich mineral, and in what was probably a neutral or reducing atmosphere in the early Earth, the only way to get those sort of minerals forming are in association with biological activities like photosynthesis, which is producing oxygen as a byproduct. So, with our earliest fossils around 3.5 billion years old, it took us another 2 billion years before we get the earliest signs of multicellular life on Earth, and then perhaps another billion years before we get the earliest signs of life on the land.